This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast, six-time PGA Tour winner, three-time All-American at the University of Florida, and noted NBC golf analyst Gary Koch to the broadcast. Gary, thanks for taking the time today. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, Jason, happy to be able to join you.
So I would say we've had a pretty exciting playoff run on the PGA Tour so far, on the push to the FedEx Cup. We have Keegan winning, Bryson going back-to-back. From a fan's perspective, it's been good. What are you sort of seeing out there, and what's your take on the first three events that we've had so far?
Well, I would tend to agree with you. Obviously, it's been very exciting. I think you have to really tip your cap to Bryson DeChambeau, finishing just outside the automatic qualification for the Ryder Cup, finishing ninth in the points list. It was obvious that he needed to do something to impress Captain Jim Furyk, and I can't think of anything better than winning the first two FedEx Cup playoff events. And as we all expected, he was certainly made one of those picks by Jim Furyk. Last week, great stuff with Keegan Bradley. Been a long comeback for him. Certainly one of those players that the anchoring ban that came into effect a couple of years ago had just an absolutely devastating effect on. You look at it statistically, his putting, which was never great, but certainly adequate by tour standards, got very poor and, forced him to really try a bunch of different methods. He's finally locked in now with this, what I'd call the Webb Simpson method or the Matt Kuchar method, where he's got the grip of the putter lodged up against his left forearm, and a lot of hard work, a lot of practice. I talked to his caddy last week, Chad Reynolds. He said he's doing more putting drills and spending more time on the putting green than he is on the range, which to me is great when a guy acknowledges his shortcomings and knows that there's an area of his game he needs to improve. And he certainly did it last week, ranking first in strokes gained putting there at the BMW Championship.
As a former tour player, your perspective on this, of how hard is that to go through, as talented as he is, to wait since 2012 and then go through that change and being patient enough to know that you can still get it done and not push too hard as competitive as these guys are? How hard would that have been for Keegan to remain that patient, sort of kind of climb to the top of the mountain again?
It's very difficult, and I can speak from experience. I won my second year on the PGA Tour in 1977, and not long after that, a year or so, year and a half after that, had a thumb injury, had to have some surgery, and try to come back from that, and didn't win again until 1983. It's very difficult. You've reached the upper echelons. You know that the ability is there. You know that you're capable of winning golf tournaments or contending to win golf tournaments on the PGA Tour, and then all of a sudden, you're not. And it's very tough. You try a lot of different things. You work hard. Sometimes you work really hard and you see no results, and that gets very frustrating. It really does take a great support group around a tour player who goes through that, from family to instructors. You need constant reminders that, you are good. You were at that level at one point. There's no reason why you can't get to that level again. And my hat's off to Keegan. I know how hard he's worked, and a lot of the circumstances in his case were beyond his control, as I mentioned, with the anchoring ban coming into effect and affecting an area of his game that is so critically important on the PGA Tour.
Looking forward to the Tour Championship at Eastlake, you have Bryson, Justin Rose, Tony Finau, Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas. They're right in the driver's seat for the FedEx Cup. And, obviously they're all playing quite well, a victory at that tournament as well. from your perspective, which player do you sort of like out of that group the most for the final event? And then, you know, which one sets up with the golf course? Which player in the golf course are the best match, per se, in, out of those five?
Well, yeah. You know, interestingly, the guy who's number one has never played there. So that'll prove to be a big question mark for Bryson DeChambeau. Does he have the game that can work at East Lake? Absolutely he does. But East Lake's a very unique golf course. Bermuda grass, which they don't play a tremendous amount of on the PGA Tour. Bryson, you know, grew up in California, so he wouldn't have had the most experience on Bermuda grass. On down the list, I would be very hard pressed to get a bet against Justin Rose, just because he seems to be such a complete player at this point in time. Every single aspect of his game seems to be good. He's another guy that has made a real commitment to make himself into a better putter. You look at the putting statistics going into last week, and I'm sure he ranked high last week, but a year ago, he was 123rd in strokes gained putting. This season, he's 14th. That is a dramatic change. He's in the top 10 in putting from inside of 10 feet. That was always an area of his game that was a little suspect. But he's done the work. He found an instructor, and Phil Kenyon, a putting instructor, changed and committed to the claw grip. And has worked really hard. And Justin has had some success at East Lake in the past. He's had some good rounds there. He hasn't been able to put four rounds together there. But I'd be very hard-pressed to bet against him.
And then we have this little event coming up at the end of September, Ryder Cup. Mm-hmm. Your overall thoughts on the event, with both teams being as stacked as they are, your views of each team, and then your views of the captain's picks, and was there one side or the other where you thought the captains kind of got the most out of those selections?
Okay. Well, first of all, the event itself is truly unique. It is unlike any other golf competition that I certainly have ever, you know, participated in or had the privilege of broadcasting. The emotion, the finality of match play, it's so fun to watch or to be a part of as a broadcaster, because you see it bring out some of the best in some players, who play maybe even beyond what you would have expected their capabilities to be. And on the flip side of that, it can bring out sometimes the worst in some of the greatest players in the world. They can struggle. They can succumb to the nerves and the pressure. So it is a fascinating 3 days of competition. As far as the two teams are concerned, both I think are strong. No question about that. The European side to me with five rookies is, you know, perhaps a question mark for Thomas Bjorn, the captain of the European side. The good news is with five rookies, he's playing, quote, a home game in Europe. So that should make it a little bit easier for his side and those people who are playing for the first time. The U.S. team, strong, obviously. You know, all the players that we talked about that'll be at the Tour Championship are on the team. You know, and there's a different feeling amongst the U.S. team now, and you've seen it over the course of the last Ryder Cup and the last year's President's Cup. The core group of younger players have the built-in camaraderie that I think perhaps U.S. teams of, you know, 10, 12 years ago lacked. The young guys, you know, Ricky Fowler, Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, those guys hang around together and do things together away from the golf course all the time. It reminds you a lot of what the Europeans have done for years, and their tour just being different than the PGA Tour. They play in smaller areas. They travel from country to country together. They stay in the same hotels together. They eat dinner together all the time. Now we're finding a group of American players that are doing that as well, and it's not forced. It's coming naturally. So I think that makes for a great camaraderie amongst the U.S. team. And I think, I'd be very surprised if they don't go over there and win this Ryder Cup. It'll be nice to see. I know we're supposed to be impartial as broadcasters, and obviously we are during the course of the telecast, but we are American, and they haven't won over there in 25 years, so it would be great to see the U.S. team go over to France and bring that Ryder Cup back with them when they come back to the United States. All right, next you want to know about the captain's picks.
Yes, sir.
Jason, I would say that for the most part, Furyk's picks were pretty much a given. Tiger certainly has earned his way on with his consistently good play throughout the year, especially contending in a couple of majors, and he's Tiger Woods. And, you know, you go to the first tee as a European player and you have to play against Tiger Woods, there's still that wow factor that Tiger brings. Tony Finau, to me, just so consistent all year long, 11 top 10 finishes, tied for most on the tour this season with Dustin Johnson. Birdie machine, hits the ball long, although everything we're hearing about the golf course there in France, it's not going to be so much about length, it's more about accuracy off the tee. And I would imagine that the European captain, Bjorn, will probably have the rough up and make it a penalty for missing the fairway. But, you know, Tony Finau is one of those guys that can hit a driving iron about 290 yards dead straight most of the time. So he'll be a great partner, especially in the four balls. Mickelson, I was, you know, maybe a little bit surprised about his play of late. Certainly hasn't been up to what it was the early part of the season when he won again for the first time in a long time and had several top 10 finishes. But again, he's Phil Mickelson, and he's played, I believe this is his 12th consecutive Ryder Cup team. So he knows the inner workings of the team room. He brings a lot as far as experience, having played, over in Europe in that hostile environment. So I certainly could see him being added to the team. And I think he'll add a lot, not just on the golf course, but in the team room and helping with Furyk and his assistant captains in a lot of their decision making. And, finally, Bryson DeChambeau, like I say, he earned his way. There's no question winning those first two playoff events. I think he'll probably end up partnering with Tiger. They seem to have found this bond together and played a lot of practice rounds together. And don't be surprised if we see them paired up in either the alternate shot or the better ball. Bjorn's picks, I think obviously because of the five rookies that he has on the team, he looked for experience, and he certainly got the experience with, Ian Poulter, the lightning rod for the European Ryder Cuppers for years. I can't tell you how many times, and I know you've watched it as well, when he makes those crucial putts and his eyes get wide like saucers and he's yelling and screaming, and he brings a tremendous amount of energy and experience to the team. Henrik Stenson, even though he hasn't had the greatest of seasons this year on the PGA Tour, he's still one of the premier ball strikers in the game. Going into last week, he led the PGA Tour in both greens hit and regulation and driving accuracy. So he'll be a tremendous partner. He and Justin Rose have done extremely well in the last few Ryder Cups together as a team. So would be not surprised at all to see that continue. The other two, Paul Casey and Sergio Garcia. Casey hasn't played on the Ryder Cup team in quite some time because he had given up his European Tour membership. Decided to take that back up because he wanted to play on the team. Certainly has had a good season, a win on the PGA Tour. And, another guy who strikes the ball extremely well. So wasn't overly surprised by that pick. The Garcia pick was interesting. By anybody's standards, he's not had a good season. Missed the cut in all four of the majors. you know, it just has not been the type of play that we're used to seeing from Sergio. But he has played on a lot of Ryder Cup teams. His record in the Ryder Cup is extremely good, both in the individuals and in both the four ball and alternate shot formats. So I think that one was as much about experience and with the hope that being put back into that environment of the Ryder Cup, that it will spur Sergio on to play the way he's capable of playing.
Yeah, why do I have a feeling that Sergio is not going to be a problem whatsoever? I think in the magnitude of that event, he shows up and he turns back into Sergio Garcia.
I would agree, Jason. And the other is, you know, it's a different way of playing. I mean, it's match play. And match play and stroke play are totally different, especially in that environment. I mean, you know, you're looking for brilliance. And if it's only brilliance on five or six holes in the course of an 18-hole match, that can determine the outcome of the match. So I agree with you. I think Sergio will turn into Sergio in a few weeks.
You brought this up a little bit, and it's kind of been a newer thought process on the Ryder Cup of the amount of influence the captain can have on the golf course setup. And do you think there's real relevance to that, or are these guys so good that, you know, if you want to make it tighter, fine, you make it tighter. Like you said, Tony Finau can hit a driving iron 290 yards. Do you think there's something actually to that, or do you think it's really not that big of an influence at the end of the day?
Well, I think the way the courses are set up now by the captains, they try to set them up to make their squad feel as comfortable as possible. So in other words, when the Ryder Cup was at Hazeltine 2 years ago, Davis Love had very little rough and had a lot of the hole locations set in very easy positions. He wanted his team, because they naturally play a very aggressive style of golf, to be able to hit driver as much as they wanted to and try to make birdies. And, you know, consequently, it worked out great. It was very exciting because there were a tremendous number of birdies made, holes being won by birdie with birdies and not very few holes won with pars, which to me is again, as a viewer, makes it much better. As I mentioned, don't be surprised when they go over to France if the fairways are tighter and the rough is higher, because statistically, I think if you look at it, the European team probably drives the ball straighter than the U.S. team. Again, you're making your own team feel more comfortable. The other is, don't be surprised if the greens are running at about 10 and a half on the stimp meter, rather than the 12 that the U.S. team plays on a normal basis. Now, in saying that, obviously, a lot of the Europeans play quite a bit of golf over on the PGA Tour, so they are playing greens that are 12 on the stimp meter as well. But they also still go back and play in Europe on a regular basis. European Tour greens are never, ever as fast as they are on the PGA Tour. So they have more experience with greens of that speed. So again, you're trying to make your team more comfortable than the other team, make them have to make less adjustments. And, you know, is that a huge factor? Can the other team make the adjustments that are necessary? Sure they can. They're great players. But you're just trying to get, to me, you're trying to give your team a perceived advantage.
Well, let's talk about your golf game. How often are you playing these days? And do you miss the competition out, you know, playing against the best in the world, you know, for would be the Champions Tour if you were still out there? And how is your game overall, and how often are you still playing competitively?
Yeah, you know, Jason, it how much do I play depends an awful lot on the time of year. You know, my number one focus obviously is working for NBC and Golf Channel and doing the coverage of their events. You know, literally with the playoffs going on now, I haven't touched a club in over 2 weeks. you know, will that change once we get through the Ryder Cup and October rolls around and I get back home? Sure. I still enjoy playing when I'm home, and with time off, I'll play two or three times during the week. I've got a lot of buddies still here in the area that I love playing with, and I still enjoy getting out there and trying to hit shots certain ways. I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction when I do it the way I had planned it. I'd like to tell you that it happens with the same frequency that it used to, but it doesn't. But the satisfaction is still as much as it once was. Competitively, you know, I try to play somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 PGA Tour Champions events during the course of the year. As I've gotten older now, I'll be 66 coming up here this fall. It's gotten harder to do from the standpoint that that's a big 15 years between 50 and 65. You look at the regular tour and, you know, a guy 21 versus a guy, you know, in his mid 30s, in theory, there's not that great a difference. I can promise you between 50 and 65, there's that great a difference. I mean, some of these guys at 50, Steve Stricker and what all coming off the regular tour, still playing extremely well there. They're going to beat me every time. I still enjoy when I get the chance to be out with the guys. Most of the guys on the PGA Tour Champions, I've played golf with some for, since I was 15 or 16 years old, close to 50 years, junior golf, college golf, and then starting on the tour together back in the mid 70s. So the enjoyment is still there. I also feel like playing competitively helps me as far as my announcing is concerned. You realize that you're not going to make every 6 foot putt. You realize that, you know, even though there's water on the left-hand side of a hole and I know I shouldn't hit it over there, I still do sometimes. And, you know, players aren't perfect. And I think sometimes, when we're up in these towers talking about these guys playing, you know, we can't believe that they would actually miss a putt or that, you know, without a bounds to the right, how could they possibly hit it there when, you know, there's all this room to the left? And the bottom line is it happens. And I think when you're still out there experiencing it, it makes the perspective that you are able to give as an announcer is just better.
Well, when you went over to the Senior British, you went through the qualifier and you got yourself in that major. Did you have to put quite a bit of time in to even be ready for the qualifier? And how satisfying was it to kind of make it through it and go play at the Old Course?
Yeah, well, it was tremendous, obviously, to be able to get through the qualifying and actually participate in the Senior Open. Preparation, I had some time before I went over to Scotland. I was home for a few weeks, so I did have a chance to play and practice on a fairly regular basis. I went over a few days early. I knew which course I would be playing the qualifying on, London Links, which was about a half hour outside of St. Andrews. So I went early and did manage to get a couple practice rounds in Sunday afternoon and Monday of the week of the regular open. But literally from Monday of the regular open until I hit some practice balls before I played on the following Monday in the qualifier, the only practicing I did was swinging in my hotel room in front of a mirror. I mean, we worked that many hours during the Open Championship and there just wasn't the opportunity to practice at all. So it was great. I mean, to play that well in a one-day qualifier. I mean, we had 150 some odd players and we knew there were 6 spots available. So you knew to have any chance, you had to shoot a good score. And to be able to do that when you knew you had to do it was very satisfying. It was a tremendous week for me. The first time I played the Old Course in competition was the Walker Cup match in 1975. I represented the U.S. team, and we were fortunate enough to win that Walker Cup match. I just don't know of any other sport where you could 43 years later be at the same venue and be playing in competition. So from that aspect, it was a very special week. Yeah, very special.
And to make the cut too, right? I mean, you're not playing that much to beat half the field.
Yeah, exactly. I played very nicely the first 2 days. Nothing spectacular, but just steady golf. Made the cut, which was a great accomplishment. I had a dear friend of mine caddying for me, so it was a great experience for him as well. He had caddied for me a couple of other times in senior opens over there, but obviously to be at the old course. We have played the old course together through the years, but for him to be there in that capacity was great. I had my wife, both my daughters, their husbands, and my grandson there. So it really truly was a family endeavor and something very special. And, to get to play all four rounds was great. It was disappointing Sunday afternoon to kind of catch the worst of the weather as I made the turn back toward the clubhouse and had to play in some driving rain and wind and didn't handle the last seven or eight holes that well. But overall, it was a tremendous experience.
Yeah, and you beat Brandel. I mean, you got high honors there, right?
And I beat Nick Faldo, too. So, two of my fellow Golf Channel, broadcasters, I managed to nip both of them. So, maybe that added to the satisfaction just a little bit.
Absolutely. Also, the guys at Cleveland Srixon, I know you've played their equipment for a long time. They have some new stuff coming out this fall. Did you have any of that stuff in the bag yet when you were over at the Open? And if you did not, when will you start looking of making that equipment switch in 2019? Or for the 2019
yes.
season, I should say.
I did not have any at the time during the Senior Open. Literally right after I got back, probably a couple of weeks after I got back, I got a set of the new irons, which look absolutely fantastic. Very much a good players look to them. Nice blade look, but yet still with the semi-cavity back for a little bit of forgiveness. So excited about that. And literally when I got home here just the other day from the BMW Championship, there's a box here with one of the new drivers. So I haven't even had a chance to hit it yet, but I will tomorrow. And looking forward to that. I've heard some very good reports and talking to some of the players, other players on the staff, the regular tour players, Russell Knox, Keegan Bradley, even Hideki Matsuyama, had a chance to chat with him last week and said, have you tried the new driver, hit the new driver? Yeah. Very good. Very good. So, looking forward to that. The new wedges are out, which I have had for a little while and very excited about those as well. Great looking. And of course the history of Cleveland with wedges is, pretty well known by anybody who's been around golf. And, these seem to be equally as good or better than anything I can remember in the past.
Will you give your feedback back to the guys so that loop is there to the engineers of to get that tour player perspective of what you think of the equipment, feel, looks, sort of, does that loop continually kind of keep going then as the progress to the next evolution of the next product cycle?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. They're great about that. Everyone from Rodney McDonald, who's in charge of all the tour operations for Srixon Cleveland Golf, to Rob Waters and some of the guys who are in the trailer that are out on the regular tour, to Roland Atwater, who's the rep in charge of all the guys on the PGA Tour Champions. I mean, they constantly want feedback. I mean, they're always asking for that. And, the nice thing to me about having been with the staff for so long and now getting up in age, and obviously as I get up in age, my abilities change. What used to work really well for me maybe 10, 15 years ago probably doesn't work as well now. So I need something a little bit different. So I think I can offer a little bit different perspective. As far as swing speed, et cetera, to how the equipment works for someone in that area, which, they want to know, because obviously, the people buying Srixon Cleveland equipment aren't all tour players. They're going to be a variety of players across the board with, you know, different swing characteristics. So the more input they get, the happier they are.
6 wins on the PGA Tour, it's impressive. You know, to get that many, if you actually look at the statistics of how many guys have that win, that many wins, there really isn't that many of all the guys who have played the tour. So out of those 6 wins, is there one that really stands out that was the most important to you or most significant?
You know, they're all important. No question about that, Jason. I mean, when you start on the PGA Tour, and I had a good amateur career, I, you know, had played well in college, was a first team All-American at the University of Florida, and had won some, you know, fairly good amateur events, came close to winning the U.S. Amateur a couple of times. So you expect to do well, but until you get out there and really experience the PGA Tour, and prove to yourself and others that you actually are capable of winning, you know, every one of them is meaningful. You know, probably 2 come to mind the most. One was 83 at Doral. Again, I had gone, you know, a 6-year period since I had won before in 1977 in Orlando. And had had a thumb injury, had to have surgery, had a torn ligament, you know, had to have that repaired. And of course, back in those days, they didn't have medical exemptions like they do now. So literally when I came back from that, I had to work my way back, you know, onto the PGA Tour and into an exempt status. So that was a huge, huge win just to prove to myself that I could still do it after, after the injury. And then the next year to win at Arnold Palmer's event at Bay Hill was probably the highlight of my career and the way that I did it. I shot 63 in the final round, which at the time was 8 under par. Par was 71, which got me into a playoff. And I then birdied each of the first 2 playoff holes to win over George Burns. So for the day, I played 20 holes. I made 10 pars and 10 birdies and hit 19 of the 20 greens that I played in regulation. So, you know, you never know when your best day of golf is going to occur. And now as I'm able to look backwards, that was clearly my best day of golf. And I can't think of a better place to do it than at Arnold's place and to be congratulated by him when I finished. Little side note to that, I was fortunate enough to play in an exhibition with Arnold and Gary Player when I was 17 years old down here in Florida with a high school teammate by the name of Eddie Pierce, who ended up going and playing on the PGA Tour for a while. And I was going to reminisce about that occurrence during the presentation on the 18th green at Bay Hill. Well, before I could even bring it up, Arnold said to the crowd, a lot of people won't know this, but I had a chance to play with Gary about, well, let's see, it would have been 15 years prior. I think I was 32 when I won the tournament, in an exhibition. And I told him then, I'll see you out here on the PGA Tour and I know you'll win some tournaments. So we're happy to have you win ours. So that, like I say, probably my finest day and most memorable victory.
Was there anybody better with people than Mr. Palmer, right? To be able to bring that up at that moment, I mean,
right.
How could you say anything nicer about someone who just won your golf tournament that he remembered playing with you when you were that age? Like, that's such a class move.
He was a very, very special person, no question about it. I mean, I've been asked about him many a time from many different people. And, you know, he loved people, for one thing. And he showed it. I've never seen anyone more genuine around people. And just, I often say, you know, he would go to the first tee and he'd be announced there'd be 2,000 people in the grandstand. And every single one of them would go home and say, hey, he looked right at me. You know, it was just, he was just that way. And, I'll never forget having had a chance, you know, years after I won the tournament to go back over to Bay Hill. And he was, you know, the commissioner of the shootout that they used to have when he would come home, you know, and spend the winters at Bay Hill. every Wednesday afternoon, they'd have a big game there at Bay Hill. And he was, you know, the organizer, and he put the teams together. And, you know, there might be 20 players. Sometimes it might even be 30 players. He was always in the first group. And he would always, as you came into the locker room there, he'd be sitting at this big round table in the prime position, looking right at the door. And as you came through the door, he would say, "All right, let me see your scorecard. How'd you do? How'd we do?" You know, and I'm just thinking to myself, what other superstar in golf would put himself in that position? He was just so happy being around all these buddies and people that love the game like he did. And, you know, just love that, you know, there were $5 bets everywhere, and he wanted to know how he did on this bet and that bet. And it was truly fun to be around him and just to see him and how he interacted with everyone.
Well, I think that's the connection, right? He could relate to anybody. If you were the CEO of Absolutely. A company to a guy at the Muni with a 15 handicap, you know, Ernie was your guy, right? It's a special
skill set. No question
skill
about that.
Special
yes,
skill set.
Yes. He was unique.
Your broadcasting career, how did that come about? Because were you still playing the PGA Tour when that happened? And then was it a part-time thing at first? Or how did that transition go from you being on the PGA Tour to a full-time announcer?
Well, it was very interesting, Jason. I had been playing for the better part of a year, maybe a year and a half, not very well on the PGA Tour. You know, game was just not there, struggling, trying hard, and just not seeing results whatsoever. Had two small children at home with my wife, and of course they weren't able to travel much, and I was away from home a lot and just not very happy. This would have been 1990, I guess. We were doing a University of Florida golf team fundraiser in the Orlando area, and one of the participants was Bob Murphy, who had played for the Gators before I did. And Bob had pretty much curtailed his PGA Tour career, had some severe arthritis, and had started working for ESPN covering senior golf. And he approached me and he said, "Do you think you'd ever like to try doing some television?" And I said, "You know, Bob, right about now, I'd try anything because I just not sure I can, you know, continue to make a living and playing golf." He said, "Well, Jim Colbert, who works with us, is getting ready to turn 50. He's announced that he is going to quit when he turns 50 and go play on the then, you know, senior tour. And we're going to have the need for somebody to replace him." And he said, "If you're interested, I'll give Andy Young, who was the producer at the time, your number and have him get in touch with you." And I said, "Yeah, you know what? Please do." Well, about a month went by and I didn't hear anything, and I continued to play and struggled and missed a couple more cuts, and I was still an exempt player at this time in 1990. And finally I got a call from Andy Young, and he said, "We've got about 5 events here between now and the end of the year where I could use you. You know, you could come out, try it, see if we think you're any good, see if you like it." And, of course, I looked at the schedule, and they were 4 of the 5 weeks were events that I normally played on the PGA Tour. And I had a huge decision to make. You know, was this something I was going to give it a shot to try television, or was I going to kind of keep trying to play? And after a long discussion with my wife, I just made the decision that, you know, the opportunities to get involved in television aren't there that often. And if it was something I was going to pursue, I better take that chance. So I did those 5 events for ESPN, which would have been mainly through the latter part of the summer and early fall of 1990. They obviously thought I had some potential, offered me a contract to work full-time for them in 1991, and I decided to do that and basically kind of ended my playing career. I was only, 39 years old, I guess, at the time, so... You know, relatively young, but, you know, I'd had my run and it had been good. And, you know, as it turned out, it was a great opportunity to get involved in something a little bit different, but yet stay around the game and all the people and be a part of something that has been part of my life for a long, long time.
Was that transition to doing TV easier than you thought it would be, or tougher?
It was definitely tougher, no question about it. You know, my role when I first started was on the ground. I was one of the on-course reporters. And, in fact, it was a small, Jim Kelly was the host, Bob Murphy was in the 18th tower, and I was the guy on the ground. And back then we had 2-hour broadcasts. We usually covered about the last 12 holes of our last 6 holes of the tournament. And, you know, which meant I had to conduct the interviews. I had to do the presentation ceremonies at the end of the event, all things that I had never done before. You know, I'd done interviews, but I always been the one answering the questions, not asking them. So it was interesting. It was certainly not that easy. I was very, very fortunate that Andy Young, the producer, and a gentleman by the name of Steve Beim, who was the director, really helped me out a tremendous amount. Andy would get together with me with tapes of the previous shows the week before, and we'd go over what was good and what wasn't. Steve helped me a tremendous amount to understand that the camera was your friend and not the enemy, and to look at the camera like you were looking at your best buddy. And you know, I look back on some of that stuff. I've got some, you know, stuff recorded that, and I wasn't very good. I wasn't very good at all, but they stuck with me. And, fortunately I got more and more comfortable, and, you know, I was on the ground there for about, 3 years, I guess. And then, Bob Murphy turned 50. And he initially had thought about trying to play some and keep doing some television as well. He tried that for a while and then decided that he was going to have a hard time playing as well as he thought he possibly could unless he committed to playing full time, which he decided to do. So they then moved me into the 18th tower, which was, of course, another new experience and a lot more things to learn there. Which, you know, fortunately, I felt like I picked up fairly quickly, having been, you know, now involved in television for a few years. And then 1996 came along. At the time, ESPN had the early round coverage of the Players, U.S. Open, U.S. Senior Open, and Tommy Roy, who's the producer at NBC, had called ESPN and asked if there was a way that I could stay over after doing the early round stuff and be involved in the NBC telecast, which Howard Katz, who ran ESPN at the time, agreed to. And at the end of 1996, my contract with ESPN was up, and I got a call from Tommy Roy asking me if I'd be interested in coming over to NBC. So fortunately, I was able to do that and been there ever since. And it's been a great run, and it's been a real privilege to be involved in the game and in a much different aspect, but one that hopefully has helped the viewers through the years enjoy golf even more.
Was it tough for you to not go on the Champions Tour full time when you turned 50, seeing like how well Colbert did, seeing how well Murph did when they were out there on that, I kind of call it those guys' prime, you know, 50 to 55?
Yeah. It was. Obviously, as I got closer to 50, that thought was certainly in my mind. I at the time, fortunately, NBC was not doing quite as many golf events as we have now. So I did have the ability to play some. I think the most I played in maybe the first couple of years that I was after I turned 50 was, I think I played 15 or 16 events. Now, it made for a very busy season in that I probably did about that same number of telecasts for NBC. So, but very much like Bob Murphy, I figured out fairly early on that, you know, the trying to do both, the chances are you weren't going to do either as well as you were capable of doing. And I had an exemption for a couple of years through the victory category that was created for the PGA Tour champions, which is guys who have multiple victories are put into a category. There are two spots in each field each week that go to that category, and who gets in is based on how many wins you have for guys that aren't exempt in other ways. And fortunately, with my six wins, I was fairly high in that category and did get to play, you know, a decent amount. And hey, I enjoyed it a lot. You know, was runner-up a couple of times in individual events there. Naples 1 year, I lost in the playoff to Watson and Craig Stadler. And I want to say Gil Morgan beat me 1 year at the Legends event in Savannah by a shot. And, you know, I had moments where I played well, but I wasn't nearly as consistently good as I needed to be to be up there on a week-to-week basis. And, you know, there's something about doing the television that just I missed when I was out playing. And I have, you know, a lot of good friends out there that were playing and people to be with. But there's a team aspect to doing television that you just don't find when you're playing golf as an individual. And that I had experienced for a while and just missed it and decided, you know what, that the regularity of knowing, you know, when I was going to be gone to do a telecast, who I was going to be with, and, you know, all that just won out over, you know, trying to play full time. So no regrets whatsoever.
Golf course architecture. I know you've done some design work in the past, and curious, what's your kind of overall design philosophy? And what is your thought of sort of, I kind of call it the second revival of golden age architecture, of having these new courses, which are a little bit more natural, a little bit more width off the tee, a little bit more playable for more players. So has that been something you've been trying to have in your designs for years, or have you kind of had to have a change a little bit as well of what the client expects at this point, for lack of a better
word? Well, I think, Jason, one of the things that that we always prided ourselves on in the design work that I did, and I did a lot of work with a gentleman out of Raleigh, North Carolina, by the name of Rick Robbins, was my partner for a lot of the design work that I did. We really prided ourselves on being able to create what the client wanted. And that was very much our mantra. We wanted to be very flexible and not necessarily come in and say, this is what you need. We always went in with the idea of, you know, who are you trying to have play this golf course? You know, is it a residential community? Is it going to be a semi-private facility? Is it a resort course? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And consequently, I think if you go around to a number of the courses that I have been involved in, you'll see different courses. You will see a lot of different things. I love the fact that architects are actually coming to their senses and saying that, you know, we need to design courses that players can enjoy playing. I've always thought that the reason why most people play golf is to have fun. It's hard to have fun when you're shooting higher than your handicap or higher than you think you're supposed to shoot. And it seems as though we went through a period of time where a lot of the courses were designed that way. And I'm very happy that a lot of people are coming back to their senses, at least in my mind, and creating, trying to create courses that that people can enjoy playing. But we, you know, our philosophy, you know, again, try to create width off the fairways most of the time. If you go to any of the courses that I was involved in, the fairway bunkers are there, but very rarely are they at a position where the people playing from the white tees are going to reach them. A lot of the holes that we design through the years, the greens are open in front to where if you happen to run the ball along the ground, you've got a chance to run the ball up onto the green. Now, there may be some you know, deeper bunkers on the sides or behind, but you know, it user friendly was always our mantra.
Yeah, somewhere in the 80s and 90s, that seemed to go sideways somewhere, where it seemed like there was this push to, I'm going to make my club harder than your club and make like a U.S. Open version thereof of your club, and then the average 15 handicap is just struggling. It's, I think it's a really great thing to have kind of like Core Crenshaw, kind of starting what they did, of bringing it back to natural and letting the land sort of be what it is and dictate how the holes are, and letting the players of all abilities, you know, like what they've done up Sand Valley in Wisconsin. It's incredible. You can play it from the good players can enjoy it, and a guy like my dad at 70 can go to the white tees and enjoy it.
Right.
It's a great way to play golf. I'm glad it's kind of coming out of, you're kind of saying the same thing I am, but there was a period of time where it was, you know, they all don't need to be U.S. Open difficult, and it turns people off to the
game.
Well,
yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, we all, not everyone, but a lot of people got enamored with, you know, the course rating, you know, the speed of the greens, you know, all these kinds of things, championship, you know, whatever that, you know, you want to include under the definition of championship golf. And, you know, the bottom line is when you take a look at the statistics, the majority of the people that play the game don't break 90. And, you know, you're designing courses for people that have single digit handicaps. When the majority don't break 90, those two things don't go together very well.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good trend line, kind of, I think, where we're going with it. I got three more quick ones for you here, and I'll get you out. And these are just sort of whatever comes to your mind here real quick, that we asked some of the guys who are on the podcast. But best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Ooh. Second shot, Bay Hill, the year that I won, 1984. 72nd hole, hole location over in the far right where it always is on Sunday. Back then, I had 192 yards and was able to hit a 4-iron within about 20 feet left of the hole, probably within about a foot of where I was aiming.
It's pretty good. Is there two or three golf courses that you have not played yet that are on your bucket list that you really want to go see and play?
I have never played Royal Melbourne, although I was fortunate enough to be there for the President's Cup match a few years ago, and hopefully we'll be going there again next fall when the President's Cup goes back. But I have not had a chance to play that. Looked like a fascinating golf course, and one, you know, very much of what we talked about as far as playability is concerned. Here in the United States, think about that. I didn't get a chance to play Erin Hills. We did the U.S. Amateur telecast from there. Was fascinated by the golf course and the property and the terrain and everything about it. So have not had a chance to play that, but would love to get back up there at some point and actually experience it firsthand from on the course rather than talking about it from afar.
It's good. I played it multiple times. It's really, really good. You'll enjoy it. Favorite city to visit when you're doing TV for the PGA Tour that's not a major, but is there a certain event or a city when you go to that area that you just fall in love with that might not be a major championship, but you know, if you're a golf fan, you should go see it.
Well, unfortunately, the event is going away. the Dell Technologies that we were just there a couple of weeks ago, we always stay in downtown Providence, Rhode Island, rather than Boston. It's just an easier commute to get into the event. And the downtown Providence area is clearly one of my favorites in the country. Great restaurants, great Italian restaurants. And very easy to get around, great airport to fly into, small, easy to navigate. And I know we had a dinner there on Monday night because the event ends on Labor Day. And there were several toasts made that we were really sad that we weren't going to be going back there again. And I'll miss that. I'll miss Providence.